This episode is brought to you in part by Max BMW Motorcycles, that's been outfitting adventure riders since 2002. They've got 45,000 parts and accessories available online and ready to ship to your door at maxbmw.com. And you can also sign up for their e-rider newsletter. It's free and I highly recommend it. That's www.maxbmw.com. Green Chili Adventure Gear offers American-made, heavy-duty, innovative luggage systems for all types of motorcycles. Turn any bag into motorcycle luggage with this unique strapping system that's easy to use and switch from one bike to another. And of course, Green Chili Adventure Gear is all tested in extreme weather and terrain to withstand the abuse of adventure riding, which has gained them a top reputation for tough, reliable gear. www.greenchiliadv.com. That's www.greenchiliadv.com. What is the art of slow travel, and how can you afford to take more time? How did this couple set up a passive income that provides them with monthly cash for travel, yet preserves their capital for when they return home? This episode is packed with tips, ideas, and some fresh views on travel. We're going to talk about making money on the road, budgeting, sponsorships, travel etiquette, social media for travelers, and why this couple traded in their BMWs for DR650s to travel the world. My name is Jim Martin. This is Adventure Rider Radio. Stay with us. We got a good one for you. Best Rest Products is home of the Cycle Pump Tire Inflator, Tire and Bead Breaker, Easy Air Tire Gauge, and other adventure motorcycle gear. The Cycle Pump runs right off your bike's electrical system. It'll inflate your flat tire in less than 3 minutes. It's made in the USA, and it comes with a lifetime warranty. And Motorcycle Consumer News Magazine just chose the Cycle Pump as their top pick in a compressor shakedown. Also, Best Rest is a North American distributor for Guglitech filters, the filters that should be on your bike. Visit them at www.cyclepump.com. That's www.cyclepump.com.
Hi, I'm Sam Manicom.
Nick Sanders.
Terry Borden. Sandy
Borden. Jack Borden.
Graham Field.
Austin Vince.
Jason Spafford. Lisa
Murray. David Peterson. Rachel.
Ed March. Glenn Hedstead.
Dr. Gregory W. Fraser. Dave
Barr. Michelle Lampier. Tiffany
Coates. Herbert Schwartz. Zoe
Cannell. Nathan Millward. Graham
Hoskins. Joe Russ. Jeremy Creaker.
Simon Thomas. Lisa Thomas.
Simon Pavey. Grant Johnson.
Robert Wick. Seth Simon.
Elizabeth Martin.
Carol DeVell. And you're listening to Adventure Rider Radio.
Michnes and Elsby have been traveling the world since 2010, now riding on two DR650s. They're back in South Africa in this interview, visiting home, but their bikes wait for them in South America, which they're returning to shortly, to continue an open-ended trip at this point. They also run a blog called Peaky Peaky Overland, on which they document their travels, and they offer information to help fellow and prospective travelers. Their travel style is to move very slowly and totally immerse themselves in the land they're visiting and the people they meet. And instead of saving for the trip and spending their way down to a zero balance in their bank account, before they left, they designed a passive income for themselves that preserves their capital. And what that means is that whenever they decide to call it quits and return home, they won't go back broke.
I'm Elsby Willifier. I'm part of the little blog we call Peaky Peaky Overland. We're from South Africa. We've been traveling seriously since about 2010.
Michnes, I'm Elsby's husband, first husband. also from South Africa. East London. Like she said, we started in 2010 traveling, and luckily, and with all the health, we're still traveling.
Elsby and Michnes, welcome to Adventure Rider Radio.
Thank you.
Now, am I saying that right, Michnes?
Michnes, but it's more a German, you know, but it doesn't matter if it's...
Home language is Afrikaans, so it's very rough language. We've got a lot of rough sounds in it, so it's like Michnes.
Yeah. Right. Where are you guys right now?
Currently in Johannesburg, South Africa, back just for a quick visit, 4 months to meet up with Elsby's mom again and sort out some stuff back home. And then in September, end of September, we're going back to Peru. We left our bikes in Cusco.
So you're sort of in the South American part of your journey. You've zipped home for a visit and you left your bikes there. There was no problem leaving your bikes there?
No, we actually found Peru the first country that made it very easy for us to leave the motorcycles. You have to make sure you do the correct paperwork and not just abandon the bike. But yeah, we fairly easily found a place to store the motorcycle. And the process, although it sounds very daunting, it's actually quite easy. We submitted the paperwork and within 24 hours, we got the go-ahead that we could go.
Well, as you guys said, you've been on the road since 2010. What were you doing before 2010?
Working like proper, what they call them?
Corporate rats.
Corporate rats.
Yeah. We're living at the as Michnes call it, the arse end of the world. We haven't traveled a lot outside of South Africa. So we sort of just did the hard work and investing as much as we can. And then decided, well, once we can, we will then go and travel the proper way and, you know, have time on our hand to actually experience what we go and see.
So that was your plan? You worked up to that? How many years did you do?
It wasn't a plan. What happened was in 1994, we got married in 1994. And sort of the idea started growing, but you know, you're young, you don't have money. When you're old, you have a bit of money, but when you're young, you don't have the money, but you can travel a bit. And sort of the idea and the nicety about it stuck with us. But you have to work, you have to do the stuff. You have to have two cars, one house, 1.5 dogs.
I think we also grew into it.
And it just started growing into it. And then when we started, got Elsby on a bike in...
Well, I was 27,
We started going away again and it just got more and more and we wanted to see more and get away more. And it at some stage, we just decided if we don't do it now, we can't do it at 80 or at 70. I mean, you're too old for that nonsense. Well, you can still maybe do it, but you're not going to do everything that you want to do. So we just at some stage sat down and decided that if it's not now, then, you know, when you're going to do it, you know, we have to make a decision, and that's the.
Yeah, I think from about 2000, we sort of structured roughly that this is what we wanted to do. So everything we did, we made sure that we could actually invest into income that you know that we can earn whether we're home or not. Then we just more formally had the plan structured, and here we are.
And that's why I'm asking, because I know that you guys have passive income set up so you can survive on the road, obviously from 2010 till now. So you started planning back then. What did you plan for passive income? Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, no problem. I think what we did is we looked at our situation and the country we're in. In South Africa, property is still quite reasonably priced. And we realized that if we invest in property and we invest wisely, that to a degree your risk when you're not home, running it yourself, is a little bit better than leaving a full-blown business in somebody's care. So initially we did both. We started up a little company, and we would go travel for 6 months, come back home for a couple of months, go for 3 months, come back home. And then, the travel became big noise in the ears, and we just decided, no, we don't want to have this worry while we're traveling that there is a business with offices and people. So we sort of defaulted back to what we found easier to manage while we're on the road, and it came back to rental properties.
So you're working another job, or you're using the money from your company to buy the rental properties, then you rent them out and you get that income?
In a nutshell, yes.
But it's still with its risk, you know, you can do investment income. You still have to work at it. So we still work at it, and we have a property manager. But the main thing was when we started looking at it, it wasn't so sheer. We didn't initially have the idea that we want to go travel. We knew we wanted to do something different and not just slave for the rest of our life. So when we started the properties, it was really hard work. You have to, you know, it's looking for them, buying for them, make sure they paid off. We didn't spend any money. We didn't buy new cars. We didn't waste holidays. Money. We didn't do holidays because we knew that we need to pay them off as quickly as possible. So it's at least a 15-year planning, doing things, trying to do it the right way to be able to be a business. You can do it the other way around, and we didn't want to do that. Is that we can save up and sell the property and go travel for 2 years and then go back home and you try and work again. But that to me wasn't a feasible long-term solution to things. And South Africa being South Africa, it's not like Germans or Europeans or Americans that you go back and within 4 months you might find a job. Yeah, you don't find a job. It's very, very difficult. So we had to make plans to ensure that whatever income we get
and
can
also
last us.
We had to provide for ourselves for a pension fund because in countries like Europe do provide for their citizens for quite a good amount of pension money. But in South Africa, that does not exist. So we always knew that we cannot come back to nothing. So it sort of just worked out for us that the property market gives us both. It can give us a reasonable income for us to survive on the road, not staying in five-star hotels, but also when we come back, the capital is still preserved for us.
Mm. Yeah, I really like that idea, rather than spending the capital, as you said, and coming back to nothing. You're coming back to your assets are still intact, and you lift off a little bit of income. It's a great way to do it. It's really something that could be duplicated in many countries, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure. No, there's no doubt about it. There's properties in every country, and it doesn't need to be a property. You can do investments in a stock exchange, except it you really need to know what you're doing. But why I like property is that you can see it, feel it, and you sort of know if a person is new to it and you buy into an area, you can do a lot of research into an area and you can see if it's good or bad, or, you know, and it's a very stable property. It's always one of the more stable, conservative asset classes. So it's a good way to.
But that being said, you have to just understand that in a way you're still dependent on people to help you. So you would need a property manager that knows the business because, yeah, you can get a bit of
setbacks
if it's not taken care of properly. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, everything's, you know, a risk. There's things can go wrong with it. I think the stock market is definitely much more of a risk than real estate. I think it was Mark Twain that said, invest in real estate, they don't make it anymore. So that's one,
yeah,
one thing we have
exactly.
going for us is real estate. So it's probably a good way to go.
True.
But you guys hit the road in 2010 then. Were you living off of that passive income when you first got on the road?
Well, initially we still had a small little business going, so it was a part of both of it. And then once we realized that for us to be away from the business for extended periods is not good for business, because even although you've got very good staff taking care of it, the love that you put into the marketing is not there. And our first travels were through Africa, so the internet connections weren't that wonderful.
We didn't have Facebook
at
that stage.
Yeah, and then at that stage we just decided, well, here we have to flip the coin. Is the traveling important for us, or is growing the business more important? And we sort of did our bit of thinking and consolidating, and we decided we sold the business and we basically put all the money back into property. So yeah, from about 2013, our income is from rentals.
So you headed out from South Africa and you went up, I think, as far as Israel in 2010 to 2012. Then you ended up from there going to Italy and France and a bunch of countries around there. You had a break between 13 and 15. Is that when you were getting your properties in order?
Yeah, that is when we did. We sold the business, got the properties in order,
yeah.
And
through Africa, we took a couple of breaks coming home. So we did about 6 months up to Ethiopia, and then we did a couple of more months, 3 months up until Egypt, and yeah. So we really just the business we had to come back home for, but then yeah, the break that we took was basically selling, consolidating. And yeah, then we hit the road permanently once we hit the Americas.
So how do you guys travel? You're traveling, obviously, by motorcycle. That's a given. But what sort of bikes are you riding? And what's your idea of travel? I mean, are you staying in hotels or how do you do it?
Well, we're not the luxury travel, so we try and stay our budget as low as possible for start. But obviously, we work on about a 40 to 60 currently US dollar a day. But we try so the less we spend, the longer we can travel, and we build up a bit of a savings bucket there. We first off started with BMW Dakars because we had them. It was in South Africa, so we used them all the way up through Europe. But the Dakars and BMW it turned out to be really expensive bikes to travel with. Maybe the older bikes, like the R80s and stuff, was a lot cheaper. But we got into Sudan, for example, and you pay $100 for a water pump set, but it costs you $400 to get it to Sudan in 3 weeks of sitting doing nothing. And it just kept on breaking and kept on breaking. And they were really heavy.
High on maintenance.
And they were high on maintenance. So when we got into Europe, we finished a Europe trip, and then we were supposed to go back to Europe to do Asia. And then we sat and contemplated while we're selling the business that, is it good? The bike's already got 80,000 Ks on them. And the money we spend on repairing them, and a BMW, the pricing on anything is more than any other bike. So then a friend of us in Texas, Motohank, called and said, but why don't you start the Americas? For South Africans, there's no visas for Central and South America. You can come buy a bike in America. And that was essentially where the thing flipped. So we left the two Dakars in Europe, in Germany, and we bought two DR650s in Texas, which we're also able to register each on our names. And what I like about those bikes is they're very basic. They cost a lot less than a BMW to maintain, a lot less. They're way lighter than the BMW. So we did much more difficult riding than we did on the BMs even, which was really nice. And our shipping cost come down. And, the parts I had to carry was less. And it's actually very, very nice bikes. Although they're 140 years old, they're coming out of Noack's Ark. But the way that the DR is set up and the way you can customize it for yourself, I think is a really good compromise.
And I think because you know that when you're traveling this way, it's not always possible to have all the insurances on your transport. We realize that if we go for this type of motorcycle, not only don't we have to worry too much about the value of the motorcycle, but we can also now venture into areas where we would not normally go with, say, a brand new 1200 BMW. And even for me, being a woman, it's so easy to handle. And I feel a lot more comfortable if we go off-road with the DR.
And for camping, we camp, we do, we've got all, we've got our camping kit. We love camping.
Well, America, it depends on the country.
Yeah, it depends on the country. America was great to camp. It's really nice. A lot of Africa places was camp. I think in Africa, we camped like 550 days. Yeah. It was all camping. But yes, we really love camping if we can, if it's possible. Wild camping we'll do here and there if it's possible. But I mean, yeah.
Most of the time, a lot of your experiences or the people you meet is staying in campsites where there's not only other travelers but locals as well. And again, depending on the country, for instance, in Colombia, even in Mexico, they don't really have a camping culture. And their rooms for rent is cheaper than a lot of camping spots in America. So you tend to find in those countries that you will just go for a budget room. And make sure that you can meet the locals.
It's interesting you mentioned that about campsites, about staying at campsites and meeting other people, because I guess it depends on what your purpose is. And that brings me to my next question for you is, what's your purpose of travel? Why are you guys out there? What is it about travel that sort of energizes you to get out and do it? Obviously in such a big way.
Experience.
I think it's this, for me personally, it's this thing that I'm so scared I'd die one day, and I'll most probably die whenever you die, but I've got this one life, and if I don't see what I need to see, and I can only see the world, I can't go into Mars, but I can only see this world. And I'm going to be old and demented and sit at 70 and you sit and drink a beer with a friend and you say, what the hell did you do with your life? Well, I worked. for this one life in this 80-odd years that you get on Earth that you can spend in a good way, man, there's so much to see. I cannot get myself to sit down to just work and go back and forth, because we've got friends doing that and they're happy with it and it's good, but it bothers me. I cannot do that.
I think we love the experience, and I think we've settled into our way of traveling because we're really slow travelers. If Colombia says you guys got a visa for 180 days, believe me, we stay almost 180 days. because if we really love a place, it's on our list to go back to. For us, it's not about rushing through the country and tick the box and say, I've been to Colombia. For me, it's to sit down with you and say, if you ask me, tell me about Colombia, my first question is going to be, what do you like? Do you like coffee? You must see the coffee region. Do you like mountain climbing? You must see El Cocoy. Do you like the seaside? Oh, you must see this. So I really want to experience the whole package.
No, there's so much, then it's what's different, because we grew up in South Africa with a set certain norms and values, and your parents might be religious or not religious, and you believe in this and you see this, and the moment you get out there, suddenly your belief systems, whatever it is, gets challenged properly. You know, whatever you think is right or correct is not correct, or the norm is not it's not a norm for other people. You know, so it's really so interesting, and in all this world, all these people can differ this much. It's incredible.
And I think challenging as well to settle into a new country and language differences and just the way they live, what they eat, where they source their stuff. We find every day interesting stuff. People will say, but you've been in Colombia 6 months, you know, what did you see that we wouldn't see? Well, it's not only what we see, it's what we experience. It's just having a week or two in one of their cities, living like they live, to see how they tick, what they do.
Is it seeing or meeting or a combination of both, which I assume that it probably is, but I mean, is it seeing the countries, seeing the culture from a distance, or is it meeting them and becoming a part of it for a short period of time?
All of it. We want to see the country like tourists. We want to meet the people like friends, and we want a lifestyle. So I think for us, it's all of it.
But it is good to sit down in little places and just check people out and what they do and how they go their life and how they talk and how they interact. And if you stay in a place, this is a nice thing about staying in a place for 2 or 3 weeks, is you go the same route every day. You go walk the morning and you walk and you see the little local guys put out their shops, and they do that every day. Tonight they pack up, tomorrow they go again. And it's really nice to see that this is what they do. This is how they live their life. But then you get a better idea of what they are about, you know, and how they got there, and like the South American countries with their religion, how big they love it, the ceremoniousness in Santa Marta and all those kind of places.
Yeah, and I think also because Mechnas and I both have been business people all our life, it's you sort of want to understand how they do property. You want to understand how they do. Mechnas has got a big marketing background, so he's always interested in, you know, how does it work for them to import and export stuff? Do they import and export stuff? So it goes further than just day-to-day stuff.
You know, funny thing is that there's this big thing about, do you remember the old pin-up posters you got when your dad was really young? You went into a car dealership or a workshop, and there was this pin-up posters hanging there with the very scantily clothed lady on the cover.
Sure, it was huge for automotive stuff.
Yeah, today it's you cannot do that. It's brand. It's frowned upon. But lo and behold, in Peru, that's how they do things. That's what
in
they
the
do.
Moms and pops and coffee moms, shops. It's yeah. still up and advertising it, beer.
If there's a car wash, that is what you'll get there. You know.
I still shake my head at some of the motorcycle industry is still doing that heavily, and I just don't understand it myself.
Oh, absolutely.
What's your day to day like? Like you're saying, you're traveling really slow, which you know sounds amazing. What's your day to day like? Do you stay in one spot and just sort of wander the streets, or are you moving each day, or are you going riding each day?
It depends
where we are. If you're in Cartagena, it's nice to go see the city and then get the hell out of there to the northern part, and when you're in San Miguel de Allende, it's nice to stay there for a weekend and check the stuff out. But then we get days like in Colombia. Now it's nice on Africa. Well, let's take Africa. Africa, you have to move. There's only so much you can see. So it all depends
on what is
here to see and
what is available.
And what is available. And
I think if we move from one region to the next region, it's normally day-to-day traveling. We'll get up in the morning, have a late-ish start. We normally don't plan more than 200 kilometers a day. Now, it sounds terrible, but in a country like Peru, for instance, 200 kilometers can take you more than 8 hours, depending on the area you're in. So for the two of us, we normally don't plan more than 200 kilometers. If we get to the next point early enough, maybe we'll carry on, or we just go and sit in a coffee shop and look at what's happening in the town. So it really depends on what area we are. If we're moving for a couple of days towards a new country, we might travel every day. Otherwise, we would get, if we've got enough time on our hand and we get to a nice little village up in the mountains and we really like it, we'll stay for 3 days. So, yeah, we're really open to any experience we find.
Yeah, the only long-term planning we need to do is if we've got 6 months, how are we going to pack in the entire country into 6 months?
Yeah.
Do you plan it ahead of time? Do you look at the country you're heading into and say, okay, we have 6 months, this is what we want to see? Or do you just sort of go and bump around?
Very roughly. So we would look at the country and see. I do look up what is the must-sees, the touristy stuff. And then we will pick and say, yes, we do want to see all of this. And then we start to experience the country. And as we start to get to know the country, for instance, in Peru, we really very quickly realize that you can't do 1,000 kilometers a day. So there's not hopping around in the country quickly. So we sort of had to structure it a little bit to make sure that we don't rush it too much. But yeah, broad strokes.
No, we do planning on routes. We do a lot because you can do the easy routes, which is like the main routes and stuff, but we don't do that. So to do the planning on getting some really nice back roads or the places that people don't generally venture to, you have to do a bit of planning. That we do often, especially if we get into a place to go see, you know, I go into Google properly or into OSM maps and go look for those small little spaghetti-sized roads and what is there, why, you know, what's going on there. So the routes we do plan.
And then, of course, we speak a lot to the locals. We would ask them and even ask the biking community or the 4x4 guys, you know. We would like to see some of your back roads. What do you suggest? So it's a combination of planning, talking.
Dangerousroads.com is also a very good source of
yes, absolutely.
Of roads and back places.
Which was? What did you say?
Dangerousroads.org,
I think, yeah. Dangerousroads.org. So you look that up and you try and find spots that are difficult to ride. So you guys are into some serious riding then, as far as technical riding.
Ach, we try. It's a trade-off. You can't go and do enduro stuff because if you get hurt, your trip is over, and it's expensive. It's ludicrously expensive. And with medicals, like even World Nomads, you don't want to... There's a trade-off. We do technical as much as we can, but not
enduro.
We can't go do enduro stuff because your bike costs you a lot of money if it starts breakdown and the maintenance on a bike and if you break the ligaments and stuff. So you have to be fairly careful on what you do in that. But we're not gonna shy away if there's really nice roads to do. But
we've also found that a lot of the roads that people deem very dangerous, we would speak to the locals, and then it would be maybe a comment that somebody wrote on the website a couple of years ago, and in the meantime they've paved the road. So although we do the research online, we always still ask the locals. And in Peru we have found some of the most amazing roads right across mountains that if you look on the map you would say, oh, this is going to be a risk for us. And then you come there and it's a single lane tarred road, but spectacular.
Stick around for more coming up with LSB and Mickness right after this 2-minute break. We're just going to thank a couple of sponsors to help bring this episode to you and help make this whole thing possible. One is IMS Products. If I were to go out and buy a new bike today, one of the few mods that I would make, and I think regardless of make or model, is I'd replace the stock foot pegs with wider pegs that have a better grip. Because I think foot pegs are extremely important. I think any rider that knows what they're doing, they're going to think the same thing. We need pegs that will keep our feet in contact with the bike. A wider peg will not only give you added stability, but a better designed wider peg will give you a better connection with your bike. So you got that stability, you got the added leverage and the connection. And that certainly is important when you get in the rough stuff, but even on the road, even long distance on the road, a wider platform is going to help. If you're serious about riding, then you definitely should get serious about your foot pegs. IMS has been making parts for motorcycles since 1976, and much of that has been for racers. I mean, it was founded by racers, it's still run by racers and ex-racers. They take what they learn on the racetrack about durability, function, and design at the highest level. And then they use that to develop foot pegs for us adventure riders. And even if most of your riding is on a good surface, you know, on fire roads and even on asphalt, a larger, well-designed peg will add comfort, control, and confidence to your ride. Do yourself a favor. Drop by the website, www.imsproducts.com. Have a look at their foot pegs and fire them off an email. And anytime you deal with them, anytime you talk with them, see them at a show, whatever, please drop our name. Let them know that you heard them here on Adventure Rider Radio. I've mentioned it before. I'm running the IMS pegs on my bike, and I absolutely love them. I've got the rally pegs on there right now. Again, the website, www.imsproducts.com. I just have one more that I want to mention, and that is Overland Expo East. And by the way, you know, the advertisers that we take for this show, they're only advertisers that complement the things that we do here. So we're always hoping that you learn something from it and you're getting something from the ad, and we don't accept just anybody. So I feel good about the companies that support this show. I really do. And Overland Expo East is certainly one of them. It's coming up November 9 to 11 in Asheville, North Carolina in the U.S. It's, as usual, at an incredibly impressive venue called the Reeb Ranch, and they have amazing venues for this. So if you haven't been to an Overland Expo, it's a huge event for overlanders of all kinds, motorcycles included, whether your vehicles or motorcycles, but in our case, it's motorcycles, and there's so much going on at Overland Expo. It's really difficult to describe it all. I mean, really, it's got to be the biggest thing, the biggest show you could ever attend like this, and a lot of opportunities there. They've got vendors showcasing products and answering questions. That is a prime, I think, opportunity to stand right in front of people who are selling the products and ask them questions about it, inquire, make a personal connection with them. Also, they've got people doing demonstrations, like specialized classes, over 175 hours of specialized classes, slideshows, and programs to help get you trained. Hundreds of experts, teachers, authors, and videographers, just really so much going on. If you like adventure, and particularly the idea of travel, long or short, then treat yourself to a weekend at Overland Expo East this November 9 to 11. You'll get to see what other travelers are using. You know, you have an opportunity there to meet other people that are like-minded, and meet and talk with people who have done these things. They've been there, they've done adventures, and they're willing to share their experience and make it easier for you. And not only make it easier for you, but because, you know, you might say, well, that'll take some of the adventure away. Well, not really. What that does is it frees you up to explore more and do things safely and better organized. So drop by the website, www.overlandexpo.com. Click on Go East. They've got a number of different ways you can attend. Now, remember, you've got to buy the tickets online, so go and do that now. I would highly recommend it. The show is very popular. They only do West and East, and they fill up fast. On Saturday night, they have a moto party, which is a dinner, etc., for motorcyclists. They give away thousands of dollars in prizes. Again, drop by the website, www.overlandexpo.com. Click on East, buy your tickets online. When you do, anytime you're dealing with them, please throw a name in there. Just let them know you heard them here on Adventure Rider Radio. Overland Expo East, November 9 to 11 this year, 2018. You guys did a tour in the States. I think you went up the West Coast, or at least you did West Coast and Midwest. I guess that was 2015 to 17?
Yes.
2015 yeah. to 17.
Right. Yeah. You did that on your DR650s. What was the DR650 like to ride in the States?
Amazing.
Very nice. Really nice. Look, it's slow. You do, 60 miles? We do 60 miles an hour. So it's boring as hell. On Tar Road, it's really boring. So we don't do... We do like 100 kilometers and then stop and drink. But luckily, Americans, there's so many places to stop. Oh, so
the back roads was amazing. Yeah, and that, Moab.
What's that? BDR maps?
Back road maps?
Back road country maps or something. That's really, really nice. We use that a lot.
Mostly in America. And we sort of try to stay off the main roads, except for the ones that we had to do, like Highway 1, etc. But most of the time we use the back road maps.
Yes, we did part of the TAT, which I call a TAT, but only part of it. We did White Rim Trail, which is amazing. I would have loved to camp there. And then some the Magruder Corridor. The DR is perfect for the Americas, especially North America.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would complain that it doesn't have good coverage on it. You know, there's no fairing on it or anything like that. You're sort of wide open to the wind, whereas some people like to have a little bit more comfort. I mean, same as a KLR. The KLR is fairly wide open, but the simplicity of the bike is incredible. I mean, you don't even have a radiator to worry about.
No, exactly. I don't want to change water pumps like in the BM in a bush.
But we also made our bikes a little bit more comfortable. So we did put in a bigger tank. So our range is not bad at all. We put up a higher windscreen to just be a bit out of the wind. And we've put on sergeant seats, which is very comfortable. So although if you look at the bike the first time, you go, oh, maybe this is not good for long road. Once you've done a few adjustments, you settle into that bike amazingly.
But also, Jim, it's not that, we don't need to do 130 or I don't know what's the miles an hour, but you don't need to do 100 miles an hour or anything. If you're on a trip, you have the time to, we stick to between 80 and 100 kilometers an hour because I get 20% better mileage on fuel. Your sprockets and chains last longer, your tires last longer. So you don't need to do 120 kilometers an hour on a piece of tar. And the wind, even now with our screens, is not that high. It's still not it's 56,000 k's late and it's not an issue.
Our style of riding. So we don't have a time limit. So if you've got a time limit and you want to do the whole of South America, yes, you would need a stronger bike to put some kilometers on the highways. Otherwise, you'll never make it in a short period. But we found that since we left South Africa, even with the Dakar, because you're in a different country and it's different rules, and some countries has got animals on the road, your speed dropped to about 80 kilometers an hour anyway, maximum. So, except in America, like on Highway 1, I must truly say we haven't missed the speed too much.
I don't need the speed there. When I'm back home, yes, you want to go to Cape Town, you want to go to Namibia, yes, you said it 1,000 k's, you do it in 2 days and all those kind of things. But I don't know, on a trip, I don't see the need for
it's
it.
It's a different style.
Yeah, and the simplicity and cost. You mentioned the cost. I mean, clearly between the BMW parts to the DR, there's a huge difference there if you're going through a lot of them in particular.
Yeah, right. No, for sure. No, I mean, my toolkit on a BM was 8 or 10 kilos. I can't remember exactly, but the DR toolkit is 3 kilos. The bearings is less. The shock is less. I can take a shock out of a DR in 20 minutes, and on a Dakar it took me 2-3 hours. Just everything is, there's nothing wrong with the BMs. I've got an HP2, we still got a 1200 GS. It's really beautiful bikes, but for this kind of travel.
What do they say? Horses for courses.
Horses for courses, yeah.
That's true. So you went down to Central America, and as you said, you're in Peru now, or at least that's where your bikes are, and that's where you're going back to. What's the plan? You're further south?
We're still sort of debating because we normally don't have a deadline, except now because we want to go down to Shire and we want to see a lot of Bolivia. We have to take the weather into account. We've also got wonderful friends that sort of hanged around in Peru, Bolivia area so that we can all travel a little bit together. So we're still debating, but probably be back in Peru for a couple of weeks, head into Bolivia, and then slowly start making our way down to Ushuaia.
You guys have a blog that you put a lot of time into. Why did you decide to do a blog for this?
We didn't want to do a block in the first place, but then what happened was I started to look in 2010. So I started to look at information for overland travel, because a lot of the forums, like Adventure Riders and all these, it's people talking, but they only do short trips. There's no information on long trips.
There wasn't a lot for Africa,
and especially nothing for Africa. So, and then I thought, but maybe we must start one and we must write up the stuff that other people at least can benefit from the stuff that we use. And then as we started doing that, our friend says, but why don't you just write a little bit? Okay, all right, so we'll write a little bit. So the thing started from there. So, and now it's actually, no, it's okay, because what happened was in Nicaragua, I think. So we book into the customs, we sat there for like an hour, the guys were really nice. The one guy comes out of a back office and he says, so you're picky picky. And both our eyes lit up like, what the hell? You know, what?
How do you know this?
Picky. And he takes us into the back room and he's got Facebook open there and a website open there. And it's like, this is you. Yes, it's us. And you're traveling. Yes, we told you we're traveling. Oh, and the whole thing changed. Everything changed.
We got cold water. We sat in an aircon office. Yeah, so, they went to pay our visas for us.
So suddenly having this blog thing going and a bit of a Facebook presence helped us to, I don't know, it just made things a little bit easier. So they didn't look at us like I don't know, some dodgy.
But
whatever.
I also think it's an extension of Mechnas. Mechnas loves marketing. That's been his career. It's been what he's loved doing. And this is sort of an extension. Because even although you're on the road, you can never not be or do what you used to do. So both of us still do some work and research while we're traveling. And I think the blog is just an extension of that.
It looks very professional, and it comes across as a commercial enterprise almost. You know, when you look at it, it looks like it's too good for someone who's just traveling and posting their stuff up. So,
thank you.
So the interesting thing is, though, you don't have sponsors.
No. So I would love to have a sponsor, but man, it's hard work. I've written an article about it because we were on both sides of the fence. When we started our own brand, all-terrain gear, ATG, it was specifically made for motorcycle stuff. So we got a lot of offers for sponsors. We got a lot of requests for sponsorship. And out of that, we just decided the sponsor thing is not going to work. But then over time, as we used products, we became friends with the people that we bought the products from. And I'm always happy to, if your product really works and it's nice, I'm happy to put a hashtag and say it works and stuff like that.
We always said that we want to be honest with whatever we have on the motorcycle. And even when we used our own products, when we still had our company, we would, for us, it was easy to then do adjustments on the product so that it works for us. And we always said the same. If somebody sponsors us, we're only going to be honest. So if I'm officially sponsored, I can't be honest always. We tend to just, and I think we just love the freedom. We've been committed to jobs until we started traveling in 2010. And we just like the free lifestyle we've got now.
I think also if you talk about sponsorship, is why do you want sponsorship? You want free stuff. Because you don't want to pay for it. Okay, so fine. It doesn't cost an arm and a leg to kit you out on a bike. The bike costs a bit of money, but your bags and all your stuff, you can buy them secondhand on eBay and pay the same amount of what a brand will give you a discount for. But you're going to work for that brand. You're going to take pictures, you're going to sit, you're going to upload the pictures, all this kind of nonsense. And then you have to spam up Facebook and Rises Unlimited and all the stuff because you are obliged now to do it because of the brand. Which is in... I think if you don't have the money to travel, you need sponsors for them, then maybe you mustn't travel. Maybe save up a little bit.
Your biggest expense when you're traveling is, I think if I have to start off, is for me, which is very important, is your medical insurance, your transport costs. So if you can get a sponsor for those two, fantastic. I'm up for those. If anybody wants to sponsor me, well, that's no problem. But those
generally
are the biggest
not the companies
costs.
That are coming to you to sponsor you will sponsor you for your medical insurance.
Exactly.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Your biggest expenses for a trip is got to be for your own pocket anyway. So you really have to question the sponsorships that you get or get offered or asked for. If it's worth the time you take out of your trip, and you know, what is the time of your trip you've got? If you've only got a year to go and you've got all these obligations towards sponsors, is it really worth it? Or is it just worth going to find the secondhand equipment and be free to do your trip?
You know, that's something that we've talked about many times on this show, but I wonder if some people, and this is what I start to think now, if some people not only like the free stuff, but they like the association. They like to be able to say that this company's sort of behind them almost as part of their travel.
That's possible. I want to say the same. I bought your stuff, like I bought Climb stuff, right? I want you to be behind me because I pay for your stuff. Senna the same. If I bought Senna stuff, I don't want to have free stuff and then say the company's behind me because I have free stuff. If I pay for Senna stuff, you are behind me because I invested in your product. So I need you to be behind me. I don't need to tell everybody about it, but if you give me a good product and it lasted for a year and I go back and I can say this is honestly a good product and it helped, that's a good thing. You know, so I understand what you say about the association. It is true. It is nice having the stickers. It is nice all those kind of things, but yeah.
I think it's just a personal
choice. It's a personal choice, yeah.
I think maybe for an individual that maybe travels alone, it's a very different decision to somebody that travels as a couple. And also, what do you like to do? If you like to talk to a lot of people on social media, maybe that is the way you want to go.
But Jimmy, so other question. I mean, when we started ATG, altering your own brand was really small. And there was a lot of small brands. Altrider, Moscow started small. All these adventure riding companies, a lot of them were small and still are small companies. But today they can fight hands-on with Touratech, for example, because Touratech's got a good budget. They might not have a good budget, but they can still, on social media and with a few sponsorship, get a good audience and get good sales generated from it. So there is very good synergy between small companies and sponsorship riders. It's just that a lot of sponsorship riders doesn't know marketing, so they would spam up a thing. They would put up a photo and a 30 hashtags, and you see this stuff every single day. So, but that there's synergy and good value for small companies out of that. That is true. That's absolutely possible. You know,
many people we've had on this show have talked about sponsorship and the downsides of it. Now, of course, there's upsides, I guess, you know, for money, product, whatever the case is. But it would certainly change your trip if you guys were running around right now worrying about having to please, you know, 10 or 15 sponsors.
Oh, no, thank you very much.
Yes, exactly. And for us, I think the thing is because we come from a business background, we were entrepreneurs. If we commit to somebody, we would want to give them the pound of flesh that we should give them. And we have found that, especially in Africa and now in South America, it's not easy to find proper internet connection. So now what happens is every time you get to an area, your hunt is not where you really like to stay. Your hunt is for the internet. And that really does change. Absolutely. The way you travel. Yeah.
If you have one or two nice sponsors, and you really do it because you love the product, you maybe have a good relationship with the brand, 100%. You know, it's not that much time, effort to give it to them or the time that they need. But to have 15 sponsors, I mean, that's ridiculous. I cannot think why people would do that. I would personally not do that.
So as far as your blog, how much time are you spending on that each day?
not a lot.
Here's another thing. I don't want to spam up people's places. So on Facebook, I would post up pictures. I don't know.
Now and again.
Maybe a month ago, I posted up pictures on Facebook. The blog is behind because I've written articles for some of the magazines and I haven't done it for our blog. And then on Instagram, which I like Instagram, is that you put up a photo, a bit of information. It's nice, it's quick, it's even. I'll do maybe twice a week if I get internet and if you have good internet in a town, or maybe do three photos a week, but that's about it. But I'm so scared of spamming people that, oh, look at this. And we don't want to micro tell people that, oh, we're eating burgers today. We don't want to get to that level. Yeah, we're going for traveling. I'm not there to tell the world that where you eat today and what you're doing tomorrow and what no, it's a difficult thing. I got scared when I saw a lot of other people spamming up the place, and I just thought, I cannot do that. It feels weird.
But that being said, yes, I think we don't post as often as we would really like to, but then, as we said, we slow travelers.
Well, you mentioned about the advantage of someone seeing what you're doing on Facebook and following your blog, et cetera, and social media certainly plays into that. Do you find that social media is a huge advantage? Like, if you were to do it over again, would you consider doing it without doing the social media, without letting other people know what you're doing?
No, we got so many people that we knew or that we became friends with because of social media.
A lot of people we met through social media.
So it's got a good use.
Oh, absolutely.
It definitely got a good use. And people invited us to stay with them and all those kind of things. So it definitely does have
an easy way to keep contact with a big group of people. So our friendships has grown tremendously since we started traveling. And I'm talking about we've got friends all over the world now. And it still seems like a platform like Facebook is such a good way to communicate with everybody, because you can see who's where, you can chat with them, you can send them some of your maps and say, try and go see this area. They can ask you for some advice, not necessarily posting it publicly, but talking to each other on Messenger or sending a private message or just sharing a post you've done before with a route. So social media for us is a really good social tool.
Yeah. But the other benefits is that we started in Africa, we really struggled. I eventually got an airline pilot smuggled a new shock for me from South Africa into Zambia. And it's really difficult. DHL, these guys are super expensive. And then you have to sit with customs. So we started a Facebook group, Overlander Mules, where everybody that's traveling, if you're going flying to Peru, you say, listen, I'm flying to Peru, I've got something I can take for anybody. So I need maybe two or three new spares, or my mom wants to send me some cookies. Right, she can give it to you, get it to you, and you bring it. Or, you know, and we have a few souvenirs we want to send back home. Maybe somebody's flying back to South Africa. Well, you can take it with for us.
So it's not for sending a bike back, but any small little parcel.
They're like small little parts, but nothing illegal. Literally just, you know.
Just one overlander helping another.
Well, wait a second. You said smuggled a shock in. That clearly, I'm not even going to go there. So the Overlander Mule page is on Facebook. So what do? You just join and then you can start making requests of somebody bringing something for you?
You just join up. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The premise of it is that we have to trust people's goodness, that you'll do what you say you do, and if people bring you something and there's a cost involved, that you pay them for it. You know, the proper trust people thing, you know. So yeah,
I think that's what we found on Facebook as well, is that it sort of gives you a little bit of a background on individuals when you talk to them, because if they're on Facebook and they've got a Facebook profile, you can sort of see if he's, you know, just wanting to take a joke with you or whether he's a serious traveler. So that's the other side of social media that's really a benefit for us.
Mm-hmm. So Susie, for instance, started Overlander's Health
page,
which is also nice because we you know, do you need a yellow fever card in Bolivia or not? You know, so she's trying to update a lot of the Overlander medical stuff on that page as often as possible.
Yeah, it's a huge advantage of Facebook for sure. And we'll put links to both of those pages in the show notes. Your ethos, I think, from what I see with your blog, or part of it, is doing the right thing. Sort of, you have a sort of, there's a lot of underlying moral values, I think, you find in your writings. I mean, you talk about paying your way while you travel and sort of not cashing in or not trying to take advantage of people. Is it a big part of your travel idea?
Yeah.
And I think it's a big part of who we are and how we grew up.
It's just be a good person.
Because it's not just, let me just set it up right. It's not just, you're not just talking about paying your way. You're talking about doing the right thing. I'm trying to think of one of the things that I read on your blog was, I think you were talking about being a good guest at someone's house, and you were giving tips on how to be a good guest, how to treat people with respect, etc. And I mean, you know, it's a type of thing that does need to be said, because I do think it's somewhat lost in society nowadays.
I think we wrote that because, you know, on your travels, again, it comes back to when you stay at home and you just do what you do every day, you think whatever the norm is for you and for the people you associate with is the norm for everybody else in the world, and it's not. So a lot of things that we would say but I thought it was like, it should be like that for everybody. And we realized that it isn't always like that. And I think both of us come from very traditional families, and that's how we were taught.
just be a good person. Just be nice.
But you also mentioned, I think, at one point about understanding cultural differences. You know, you might be in a place where, I think the one example was giving thumbs up for, you know, North Americans, thumbs up means something good. In other countries, it may not.
Yeah,
correct.
And I think it's more just to say, just be aware of your surroundings. You know, if you're in a very Catholic society or walking into a church, just be aware that there's people with other values there. So don't walk in there with your bikini top.
Yeah, and like taking photos. I mean, I take a lot of...
be respectful when you take your photographs.
Yeah, I don't shove a flash in people's faces and stuff. And when they look... You can see they're annoyed, you know, say sorry.
And if you're not sure, just ask. we're all from different sides of the world, and something that might be the norm for you is not the norm for us.
Yeah, and as corny as it sounds, you are sort of representing the motorcyclists of the world, really. So, I mean, whatever interaction you Correct. Have with someone will probably affect the next person that comes along.
Oh, that is absolutely
that is true.
That is true. And we found that.
We found it on both sides.
On people saying straight to us that they're not entertaining overlanders because of some other reasons. And other people love overlanders because the previous guys did well to them.
So we should all be aware of those repercussions of all of our actions. And it's easy to get hot-headed about something because you're frustrated with whatever. But that's going to affect other people down the road, other riders.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple thing like a bribe. You pay a bribe, the next guy is going to ask you for a bribe, and they're just going to perpetuate the problem. Luckily, I see now a lot of people, when they do talk about bribes, that a lot of overlanders are starting to understand that paying a bribe is just the wrong thing to do.
So you're not paying any bribes?
Mm-hmm. Never. I've never paid a bribe, and, well, touch wood. I've never been in a situation that bad that I had to make the decision to...
if you're absolutely forced. But you know what's interesting about the whole bribe thing is that it seems to me that there's almost like two schools of thought. There's the people who just refuse to pay bribes at all. And then there's the other people who say, you know what? It's not worth my hassle. I'm just going to give them the $5, the $10, the $20 just to get through because I don't want to sit here for 3 days. So it's almost like there's two schools of thought for it.
But you're correct, because for us, again, we're lucky that we have time on our hands. So if we get to a border post and you can see this guy is dragging his feet because he wants you to pay a bribe, we will take out the coffee kettle and make coffee because mm-hmm. we've got time. We actually had an incident in Sudan where they did exactly that to us on a Saturday morning. And that Saturday evening at 8 o'clock, we forced them to open their gates so that we could camp inside the compound. So... yes, I can understand that somebody would get irritated and say, hey, I've got 5 days to get through the whole of Sudan, and he would pay a bribe. We just say we've got the time. We put out a day for a border crossing, so if we spend it making coffee next to the building or in the field, that's fine. We sit it out.
But in Angola, for example, there was a fixture. And you pay him $20 and he runs with you and he does a thing. So you call it dealing with bureaucracy. So, yes, it wasn't really strictly a bribe.
No,
it was more a fixing thing. And you really had to use a fixer. Like in the border crossing from Sudan into Egypt,
you have
no choice but to use a fixer. There's just no other way you're going to get around that. You might now, that was an hour time. But you might know it. But like in Nicaragua, in El Salvador somewhere, we did a border crossing and the guys were dragging the feet. And I just walked up to the manager and I said to him, this is not going to fly. Either you do something, but we're standing in a queue now for half an hour to do something. And it was not 5 minutes later, we got our stamps.
It's actually surprising how many times the situation can be sorted out if you just talk.
Yeah, and be nice.
And just make sure they know you're not paying anything.
But for roadside, like people stopping us for you know, like next to the road, police and stuff, touch wood, never had an issue. Never, never, never. And we've been stopped plenty of times. Always just be nice, chat them up, do the thing, ask for a photo. We've never, touch wood, never had any issues.
Yeah, but we also did find that being on the DR in South America, I think it's because they look like old bikes. We haven't been stopped that often.
You know, we've talked about that as well, about the difference between a new bike. To me, a fancy big bike with a lot of fancy gear screams money, and I think it would to most people. And then, like you're saying, the DR650 has a much less impressive look. Now, it still may look impressive to a lot of people because, I mean, if you don't have anything, it's still a motorcycle. It still has a value to it. But do you think that plays a part into how you're actually treated?
I'm sure it does. And numerous times it happened. And Go Light happened where we were really, really invited into every little town we went into. We were invited. We had overlanders in cars and they were treated like rubbish. They even stole stuff from their cars. In a lot of African countries that happened, that when we get off the bike and you're dirty and you ask for a Coke, we ask for a beer.
And most importantly, you've got a smile
and you're
going to
smile. They sort of, I don't know why, it's because... you're on the ground level. You. I don't know why it's different, but you definitely were getting treated. And even now that we've met 4x4 overlanders in South America, they get stopped every now
their
and then.
Your experience is definitely
we get never get stopped. We just get waved past, and if they pass you or they stop you, they quickly want to ask something. But definitely there's for sure, I think, because you're more open, you're more vulnerable sitting outside, people, I don't know, there must be something to it.
Differently, yeah.
What tips do you guys have for people who may want to do something similar to what you're doing, or even just travel in general?
Man, save up as much as you can, spend as little as you can. Don't get blown over by egos and the big bikes and the big ego.
And put a smile on your face, because a smile buys you into a lot of things.
Yeah. You just mentioned budget first, the first thing as tips. You didn't say tires. You didn't say get these bags, get this bike.
No, you mentioned
budget, because that is it, isn't it?
Budget. Yeah.
Well, that can make or break your trip. We've met so many youngsters that's on the road and backpacking, overlanding in vehicles, it doesn't matter, that they would sit and have arguments with each other or have
bad days
because they don't have enough money to decide where to go next, or having to sit out in a campsite or to wild camp because they don't have the money to make the next move, or getting a flu and can't even go and buy medicine for it. And I'm just like, really, you're not experiencing this country.
You're surviving.
Yeah, I have a friend that ran into that. As a matter of fact, him and his buddy ran out of money, and they had, I think, a month to go or something. So they were down to eating one can of food each day, and one like SpaghettiOs, the other one like beans.
Oh, my word.
And they would fight over what they were going to have for dinner because one couldn't stand what the other food was.
No, that can't be fun.
But you know, Jimmy, if you're doing a 2-month trip and it sort of runs out, it's fine because you're going to go back home, you have your job, and you just carry on, you know, and you can max up your credit cards and stuff. But when you do longer trips, when you do the year trip, 2-year trip, your budget is either going to kill it for you or it's going to make it for you.
But it's also the difference. It's decide what type of trip you want. With us, We've got a monthly income coming to us. So if we start running low on cash, we've got time on our hand and we can actually sit it out. Where a lot of people will have a fixed budget or a fixed time, and that will influence your trip definitely. So do decide how you want to travel first. And my advice would be, if you've only got 6 months, don't aim for the whole South America. Aim for 1 or 2 countries.
Yeah, full ask one country, then half ask 7 countries. It's just not working. Try and rather spend your time and do 2 countries properly and enjoy it than try and rush for 6 countries and see about nothing. If you only have 6 months, only Central America for 6 months. Don't try and run all the way down to Ushuaia.
What about biking gear?
Buy the best suit you can get. Buy the best. And doesn't matter the bike so much. Well, it obviously matters, because if you're going to do 80% road trip, you can buy about any bike. But if you're really going to do dirt roads, it's going to take abuse. So buy the best shocks you can get. And if there's money left, then you buy all the little bags and all the other little stuff that you want. For gear, we've went through every kind of kit. The rain suits, all the stuff, they don't last. Now, my Badlands was quite a price to climb, but that thing has now been lasting me
four or five years.
And I don't need a rain suit because you just get it in. There's different brands, but...
We pack very lightly, and we really do. So we would go 3 T-shirts each. So the 3 T-shirts needs to be of high quality and comfort. So we will go and find proper Moe T-shirts. We've got one... Merino. We have got one suit that we're going to wear almost every day or most of the time. And you have to make sure that you can live with that suit. So... yes, spend the money on it. Don't wear a pair of pants that's going to shave through within the first couple of months, because believe me, it's not easy to replace gear, especially in Africa and South America. If you're in the bigger cities, yes, you can maybe, but places like Ecuador is extremely expensive to import stuff and not everything is available. So don't skimp on your helmet, your riding suit. The rest...
yeah.
You can buy everything you need on the go.
Yeah, and especially if you want really technical clothing, because we carry less than 30 kilos each on each of our bikes. And the pants we use is technical, it dries quickly, all this kind of stuff. So the clothing that we've now figured out after all this time, it works. We don't carry cotton anymore because they last 3 months and it takes long to dry them and all this kind of stuff. But the kit is, your gear is very important.
But you grow into it. So somebody else asked me as well the other day, so I really want to do a long trip into Africa. What should I and what should I? And I said, you know what? You probably have got everything you need at home. Pack and go. You will learn as you travel.
Thank you very much, the both of you. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you. It was nice being on the show.
That was Mechnis and Elsby from Peaky Peaky Overland blog. You can follow their adventures and read more about them at their website, www.peakypeakyoverland.com. And you can find that link, of course, and the link for those Facebook groups that we mentioned here that we talked about in our show notes, of course, on our website for this episode. I just want to remind you this episode was made possible for you today in part by Max BMW Motorcycles at www.maxbmw.com, Best Rest Products at www.cyclepump.com, Green Chili Adventure Gear at www.greenchiliadv.com, and Moto Breeze Chain Oilers, www.motobreeze.com. Well, that about wraps up another episode of Adventure Rider Radio, and we sure hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we did making it. Special thanks to our producer, Elizabeth Martin, and to you, the listener, thank you very much. And I want to take a minute now to direct you to our website. Not only are the show notes with the links, etc., from every show that we do, every episode that we do, they're all on the website. You can listen to all the episodes for free right there. You just go through it and look. And there's a search button as well. You can click on the search button and put in tag words you think that we might have covered in other shows. We've got a ton of information on the website. So drop by and check it out, www.adventureriderradio.com. Now, remember, we have the other show too, Raw, that we do once a month. That's a separate show. You need to subscribe separately wherever you get podcasts. Just make a separate subscription, search for it. Both of them are available anywhere that you find podcasts. If you like what we're doing and you want to help out, the show is built on a model of some advertising and listener support to help the whole thing work. Anything $10 or more is going to get you a sticker. We got these great Adventure Rider Radio stickers to go on your pannier, your gas tank, the side of your motorcycle. I think they look very cool. Maybe I'm biased. But anyway, anything $10 or more is going to get you that sent back to you. Anything $50 or more gets you a mention on our Raw show. We do it at the start of every Raw show, so check that out as well. And we would love it if you consider the patron option that we signed up for at the request, actually, of listeners just like yourself. So you can go on there and you can put any amount, you can pledge any amount for a monthly support payment. It could be $5, $20, whatever you want to do. We would love it because then we can count on that. And it allows us to put more time into the show for yourself. Anyway, time to get out there and ride your bike. Thank you very much. Really appreciate you listening. My name is Jim Martin, and I'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Roseanne Hansen, and you're listening to Adventure Rider Radio.